on site now for 23 months. He'd been disciplined twice for sleeping on watch and once for unauthorized use of email, but that was all. What bothered him was that Paulson knew, or believed he did. Richards had sensed it right off. Not in anything Paulson had done or said, but in the look on Carter's face when Richards had opened the van's door. Like the poor guy had seen a ghost, or worse. Nobody except the scientific staff and the sweeps set foot on level 4. With nothing else to do but stand around in the snow, a certain amount of idle conjecture among the enlisted was inevitable. Loose talk around the mess table. But Richards had the feeling in his gut that whatever Paulson had said was more than just gossip. Maybe Paulson was dreaming. Maybe they all were. If Richards was dreaming these days, it was about the nuns. He hadn't cared for that part very much at all. Way back when. So long ago it seemed like a different life entirely. He'd gone to Catholic school. A bunch of withered old bitches who liked to slap and hit, but he'd respected them. They meant what they said, and did it. So shooting nuns went against the grain. Most of them had just slept through it. But there was one who'd woken up. The way she opened her eyes made him think she'd been expecting him. He'd done two of them already. She was the third. She opened her eyes in bed, and he saw, in the pale light coming through the window, that she wasn't some dried-up seahorse like the others, but young, and not bad-looking. Then she closed her eyes and murmured something. A prayer, probably. And Richards shot her through a pillow. He'd come up one nun short. Lacey Antoinette Cudotto, the crazy one. He'd read her psych workup from the diocese. Nobody would believe her story, and even if they did, the chain was broken in western Oklahoma with a bunch of dead cops shot by rogue FBI agents and a 10-year-old Chevy Tahoe you'd need tweezers and about 1,000 years to reassemble. Still, he hadn't liked shooting that nun. Richards was sitting in his office, watching the security monitors. The timestamp read 22:26. The sweeps were in and out of containment with the rabbit carts, but nobody was having any of it. The fast had started with zero, but had spread to the others since Carter had shown up, maybe a couple of days later. This was a puzzler, but in any event, if special weapons had its way, the sticks would all be eating soon enough. By which time Richards hoped he'd be ice fishing on Hudson Bay or digging out snow for an igloo. He looked at the monitor for Amy's chamber. There was Walgast, sitting at her bedside. They'd brought in a little portable toilet with a nylon curtain and a cot where he could sleep. But he hadn't slept at all, just sat in the chair by her bed day after day, touching her hand, talking to her. What he was saying, Richards didn't care to know. And yet he'd find himself watching them for hours, almost as much as he watched Babcock. He turned his attention to Babcock's chamber. Giles Babcock, number 1. Babcock was hanging upside down from the bars, his eyes, that weird orange color, shooting straight at the camera, his jaws quietly working, chewing the air. I am yours and you are mine, Richards. We are all meant for someone, and I am meant for you. Yeah, Richards thought. Fuck you too. Richards's comm buzzed against his waist. This is the front gate, the voice on the other end said. We've got a woman out here. Richards examined the monitor that showed the guardhouse. Two sentries, one holding the comm to his ear, the other with his weapon unslung. The woman was standing just outside the circle of light around the hut. So, he said, get rid of her. That's the thing, sir, the sentry said. She won't go. She doesn't look like she has a car either. I think she actually walked. Richards was looking hard at the monitor. He saw the sentry drop the comm to the ground and unsling his weapon. Hey, Richards heard him say. Get back here! Stop or I'll fire! Richards heard the pop of his weapon. The second soldier took off running into the dark. Two more shots, the sound muffled through the comm where it lay in the mud. 10 seconds passed, 20. Then they stepped back into the light. Richards could tell from their body language that they'd lost her. The first sentry retrieved his comm and looked up into the camera.
Sorry. She got away somehow. You want us to go look for her?
Jesus. This was all Richards needed. Who was she?
Black woman. Some kind of accent, the sentry explained. Said she was looking for someone named Walgast.
He didn't die. Not right away, and not as the days went by. And on the third day, he told her the story. There once was a little girl, Walgast told her. More little even than you. Her name was Eva, and her mother and father loved her very much. The night after she was born, her father took her from her bassinet in the room at the hospital where they were all sleeping and held her, her bare skin against his own. And from that moment on, she was inside him, really and truly. His girl was inside him, in his heart. Somebody was probably watching, listening. The camera was over his shoulder. He didn't care. Fortis came and went. He took her blood and changed her bags, and Walgast talked through the hours of the third day, telling it all to Amy, the story he'd told no one. And then something happened. It was her heart. Her heart, you see. He showed her the place on his chest where this was. Began to shrink. While around her, her body grew. Her heart did not. And then the rest of her stopped growing, too. He would have given her his heart if he could. Because it was hers to begin with. It had always been, and always would be, hers. But he couldn't do this for her. He couldn't do anything. No one could. And when she died, he died with her. The man that he was gone. And the man and the woman couldn't love each other anymore because their love was nothing but sadness now. And missing their little girl. He told her the story, told it all. And when the story was ending, the day was ending with it.
And then you came, Amy, he said. Then I found you. Do you see? It was like she'd come back to me. Come back, Amy. Come back. Come back. Come back.
He lifted his face. He opened his eyes. And Amy opened hers, too. Chapter 13. Lacey in the woods. She moved at a crouch, darting tree to tree, putting distance between herself and the soldiers. The air was cold and thin, sharp in her lungs. She stood with her back against a tree and let herself breathe. She wasn't afraid. The soldiers' bullets were nothing. She'd heard them ripping through the underbrush, but they hadn't even come close. And so small. Bullets. How could bullets hurt a person? After the long distance she'd traveled, against such odds, how could they hope to scare her away with something as meager as that? She peeked around the barrel-like trunk. She could see, through the undergrowth, the glow of the sentry hut, hear the two men talking, their voices carrying easily across the moonless night. Black woman, some kind of accent. And the other one saying over and over, "Shit, he's gonna have our ass for this. How the fuck did we miss her, huh? How the fuck? You didn't even fucking aim." Whoever they were talking to on the phone, they were afraid of him. But this man? Lacey knew he was nothing. No one. And the soldiers, they were like children, without minds of their own. Like the ones in the field, so long ago. She remembered how, through the long hours, they'd done and done. They'd thought they were taking something from her. She could see it in the dark smiles streaked across their mouths, taste it in their sour breath on her face. And it was true, they had. But now she'd forgiven them and taken this thing back, which was Lacey herself, and more besides. She closed her eyes. "But you are a shield around me, O Lord," she thought. "You bestow glory on me and lift up my head. To the Lord I cry aloud, and he answers me from his holy hill. Selah. I lie down and sleep. I wake again because the Lord sustains me. I will not fear the tens of thousands drawn up against me on every side. Arise, O Lord. Deliver me, O my God. Strike all my enemies on the jaw. Break the teeth of the wicked." She was moving through the trees again. The man on the other end of the sentry's phone. He would send more soldiers to hunt her down. And yet a feeling like joy was coursing through her. A new, nimble energy, richer and deeper than anything she'd felt in her life. It had been building through the weeks as she made her way to... well, where? She didn't know what it was called. In her mind, it was simply the place where Amy was. She'd taken some buses. She'd ridden a while in the back of someone's truck with two Labrador retrievers and a crate of baby pigs. Some days she'd awakened wherever she was and known it was a day to walk, just walk. From time to time she ate, or if it felt right, knocked on a door and asked if it would be all right if she slept in a bed. And the woman who answered the door, for it was always a woman, no matter what door Lacey knocked on, would say, "Of course, come right in," and lead her to a room with a bed all made up and waiting, without saying one more word about it. And then one day she was climbing a long mountain road, the glory of God in the sunshine all around her, and knew that she'd arrived. "Wait," the voice said. "Wait for sunset, Sister Lacey. The way will show you the way." And so it did. The way showed the way. More men were pursuing her now. Each footfall, each snap of a twig, each breath was as a gunshot, louder than loud, telling Lacey where they were. They were spread out behind her in a wide line, six of them, pointing their guns into the darkness, at nothing, at a place where Lacey had stood, but stood no longer. She came to a break in the trees, a road. To the left, 200 yards distant, stood the sentry hut, bathed in its halo of light. To the right, the road turned into the trees and descended sharply. From somewhere far below was the sound of the river. Nothing about this place revealed its meaning to her, and yet she knew to wait. She dropped and pressed her belly against the forest floor. The soldiers were behind her, 50 yards, 40, 30. She heard the low, labored sound of a diesel engine, its pitch dropping as the driver downshifted to ascend the final rise. Slowly it pushed its light and noise toward her. She rose to a crouch as its headlights burst over the crest of the hill. Some kind of army truck. The pitch of the engine changed as the driver shifted again and began to gather speed. "Now?" And the voice said, "Now." She was up and running with all her might, aiming her body at the rear of the truck. a wide bumper and above it an open cargo area concealed by swaying canvas. For a moment it seemed as if she'd moved too late, that the truck would race away, but in a burst of speed she caught it. Her hands found the lip of the gate, one bare foot, and then the other left the road. Lacey Antoinette Cudotto, airborne. She was up and over, and she was rolling in. Her head hit the floor of the cargo compartment with a thump. Boxes. The truck was full of boxes. She scrambled to the front, against the rear wall of the cab. The truck slowed again as it approached the sentry hut. Lacey held her breath. Whatever happened now would happen. There was nothing she could do. The hiss of air brakes. The truck jerked to a halt. "Let me see the manifest." The voice belonged to the first sentry, the one who'd told Lacey to stop. The man-boy with his gun. She could discern from the angle of his voice that he was standing on the running board. The air suddenly tanged with cigarette smoke. "You shouldn't smoke." "Who are you, my mother?" "Read your own manifest, dickhead. You're carrying enough ordnance to blow us all halfway to Mars." A snickering laugh from the passenger seat. "It's your funeral. You see anyone down the road?" "You mean like a civilian?" "No, I mean the abominable snowman. Yes, a civilian. A black woman, about 5'6", wearing a skirt." "You're kidding." A pause. "We didn't see anyone." "It's dark. I don't know." The sentry climbed down from the running board. "Hang on while I check the back." "Don't move, Lacey," the voice said. "Don't move." The canvas flaps opened, closed, opened again. A beam of light shot into the back of the truck. "Close your eyes, Lacey." She did. She felt the beam of the flashlight rake her face once, twice, three times. "You are a shield around me, O Lord." She heard two hard pounds on the side of the truck, right beside her ear. "Clear!" The truck pulled away. Richards wasn't one bit happy. The crazy nun. What the blue fuck was she doing here? He decided not to tell Sykes. Not until he knew more about it. He'd sent six men. Six! Just fucking shoot her! But they'd come back with nothing. He'd sent them back out around the perimeter. Just find her. Put a bullet in her. Is that so hard? The business with Walgast and the girl had gone on too long. And Doyle. Why was he still alive? Richards checked his watch. 0003. He retrieved his weapon from the bottom drawer of his desk and checked the load and tucked it against his spine. He left his office and took the back stairs to level one and exited through the loading dock. Doyle was stashed over in civilian housing. The room had belonged to one of the dead sweeps. The sentry at the door was dozing in his chair. "Get up," Richards said. The soldier jerked awake. His eyes floated with incomprehension. He didn't look like he knew where he was. When he saw Richards standing above him, he rose quickly to attention. "Sorry, sir." "Open the door." The soldier keyed in the code and stepped away. "You can go," Richards said.
"Sir?"
"If you're going to sleep, do it in the barracks." A look of relief.
"Yes, sir. Sorry, sir."
The soldier jogged down the catwalk, away. Richards pushed the door open. Doyle was sitting on the end of the bed, his hands folded in his lap, looking at the empty square on the wall where the TV had once been. An untouched tray of food rested on the floor, exuding a faint smell of rotting fish. As Doyle lifted his face, a thin smile creased his lips.
"Richards, you fuck."
"Let's go." Doyle sighed and slapped his knees.
"You know, he was right about you. Walgast, I mean. I was just sitting here thinking,
When is my old friend Richards going to pay me a visit? If it was up to me, I would have come sooner. Doyle looked like he was about to laugh. Richards had never seen such a good mood in a man who had to know what was about to happen to him. Doyle shook his head ruefully, still smiling. I should have gone for those shotguns. Richards withdrew his weapon and thumbed the safety. It would have saved some time, yes. He led Doyle across the compound toward the lights of the chalet. It was possible Doyle would take off running, but how far would he get? And, Richards wondered, why hadn't he asked about Wolgast or the girl? Tell me one thing, Doyle said as they reached the parking area. A handful of cars were still there, belonging to the lab's night shift. Is she here yet? Is who here? Lacey. Richards stopped. So she is, Doyle said, and chuckled to himself. Richards, you should see your face. What do you know about it? It was strange. A cool blue light seemed to be shining from Doyle's eyes. Even in the ambient glow of the parking lot, Richards could see it, like looking into a camera at the moment the shutter opened. Funny thing. But you know, Doyle said, and lifted his gaze toward the dark shapes of the trees. I could hear her coming. Gray. He was on L4. On the monitor, the glowing shape of zero. Gray. It's time. He remembered then, remembered all of it at last. His dreams, and all those nights he'd spent in containment, watching Zero, listening to his voice, hearing the stories he told. He remembered New York City, and the girl, and all the others, every night a new one, and the feel of the darkness moving through him, and the soft joy in his jaw as he flew down upon them. He was gray and not gray. He was Zero and not Zero. He was everywhere and nowhere. He rose and faced the glass. It's time. It was funny, Gray thought. Not funny ha-ha, but funny strange, the whole idea of time. He'd thought it was one thing, but it was actually another. It wasn't a line, but a circle. And even more, it was a circle made of circles made of circles, each lying on top of the other, so that every moment was next to every other moment, all at once. And once you knew this, you couldn't unknow it. Such as now, the way he could see events as they were about to unfold, as if they'd already happened, because in a way, they had. He opened the airlock. His suit hung limply on the wall. He had to close the first door to open the second to open the third, but there was nothing that said he had to put the suit on, or that he had to be alone. The second door, Gray. He stepped into the inner chamber. Above his head, the shower head hung like the face of some monstrous flower. The camera was watching him, but no one was on the other side. He knew that. And he was hearing other voices now, not just Zero's. And he knew who these were, too. The third door, Gray. Oh, it was such happiness, he thought. Such relief. This letting go. This putting down and away. Day by day he'd felt it happening, the good gray and the bad gray coming together, forming something new, something inevitable. The next new gray, the one who could forgive. I forgive you, Gray. He turned the wide handle. The gate was open. Zero uncurled before him in the dark. Gray felt his breath on his face, on his eyes and mouth and chin. He felt his hammering heart. Gray thought of his father on the snow. He was weeping. Weeping with happiness, weeping with terror, weeping, 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 and as Zero's bite found the soft place on his neck where the blood moved, he knew at last what the tenth rabbit was. The tenth rabbit was him. Chapter 14. It happened fast. 32 minutes for one world to die, another to be born. "What did you say?" Richard said. And then he heard, both of them heard, the sound of the alarm. The one that was never, ever supposed to ring, a great atonal buzzing that ricocheted across the open compound so that it seemed to come from everywhere at once. Security breach. Subject containment level 4. Richards turned quickly to look toward the chalet. A quick decision. He swung around to point his gun at the spot where Doyle had stood. Doyle was gone. "God damn," he thought, and then he said it. "God damn!" Now there were two of them on the loose. He quickly scanned the parking lot, hoping for a shot. Lights came on everywhere, bathing the compound in a harsh, artificial daylight. He heard shouts from the barracks, soldiers running. No time to deal with Doyle now. He raced up the steps of the chalet, past the sentry who was yelling at him, something about the elevator, and took the stairs to L2, his feet barely touching the steps. The door to his office was open. He quickly scanned the monitors. Zero's chamber was empty. Babcock's chamber was empty. All of the chambers were empty. He hit the audio feed. "Sentries, level 4, this is Richards. Report." Nothing. Not a word in reply. "Main lab, report. Somebody tell me what the fuck is going on down there." A terrified voice came through. "Fortis?
They let them out."
"Who? Who let them out?" A blast of static, and Richards heard the first screams coming over the audio, and gunshots, and more screams. The screams men made when they died.
"Holy fuck!"
Another blast of static.
"They're all loose down here! The fucking sweeps let them all go!"
Quickly, Richards called up the monitor for the sentry post on L3. A broad mural of blood was on the wall. The sentry, Davis, was slumped on the floor below it, his face pressed to the tiles as if he were probing the ground for a lost contact. A second soldier stepped into view and Richard saw that it was Paulson, holding a .45. Behind him, the doors to the elevator stood open. Paulson looked straight into the camera as he holstered the gun and removed the grenade from his pocket, then two more. He pulled the pins, using his teeth, and rolled them into the elevator. Then he took one more look at Richards, who saw his empty eyes, drew the .45, raised it to the side of his head, and pulled the trigger. Richards reached for the switch to seal the level, but it was too late. He heard the explosion ripping through the elevator shaft, and then a second blast of sound as what was left of the car went sailing to the bottom, and all the lights went out. At first, Walgas didn't know what he was hearing. The sound of the alarm was so sudden, so completely alien, that for a moment it obliterated all thought. He rose from his chair beside Amy's bed and tried the door, but of course it wouldn't open. They were sealed inside. The alarm rang and rang. A fire? No, he reasoned over the din in his ears. It was something else, something worse. He looked up at the camera where it hung in the corner. "Fortis! Sykes, goddammit! Open this door!" He heard the pop of automatic weapon fire, muffled by its passage through the thick walls. For an instant he thought hopefully of rescue. But of course that was out of the question. Who would rescue them? And then, before he could generate another thought, there was a great concussive bang and a terrible roar that ended in a second bang, louder than the first, bringing with it a deep, sonorous trembling, like an earthquake,
and the room plunged into darkness. Walgast froze. The blackness was total, an overwhelming absence of light, completely disorienting. The alarms had stopped. He felt a blind urge to run, but there was nowhere to go. The room seemed to expand and to be closing in upon him all at once. "Amy, where are you? Help me find you!" Silence. Walgast drew a deep breath and held it. "Amy, say something. Say anything." He heard, behind him, a soft moan. "That's it." He turned, listening hard, trying to calibrate the distance and direction. "Do it again. I'll find you." His mind began to focus, his initial panic giving way to a sense of purpose, the task at hand. Cautiously, Walgast took a step forward toward her voice, then another. A second moan, barely audible. The room was small, not 20 feet square. So how could it be that Amy should seem so far away from him in the dark? He heard no more gunfire, no sounds at all from outside. Only the soft notes of Amy's breathing, summoning him. Walgast had reached the foot of her bed and was feeling his way along its metal rails when the emergency lights came on, two beams that shot from the corners of the ceiling over the door. Barely enough to see by, but enough. The room was the same. Whatever was happening outside, it had yet to reach them. He sat by Amy's bed and felt her forehead. Still warm, but her fever was down, her skin a little damp. With the power out, her IV pump had stopped. He wondered what to do, and decided to disconnect her. Perhaps this was wrong, but he didn't think so. He had watched Fortis and the others change the drip enough times to know the ritual. He adjusted the clamp, sealing off the flow of liquid, and withdrew the long needle from the rubber stopper at the top of the tube buried in the skin of her hand. With the IV disconnected, there was no reason to leave the port in place. He removed this also, pulling it gently away. The wound didn't bleed, but to be sure, he covered it with gauze and tape from the supply cart. Then he waited. The minutes passed. Amy shifted restlessly on the bed as if she were dreaming. Walgast had the curious intuition that somehow, if he could see her dreams, he'd know what was happening outside. But part of him wondered if any of it mattered now. They were well below ground, sealed away. They might as well have been locked in a tomb. Walgast had all but resigned himself to their abandonment when he heard, behind him, a hiss of equalizing pressure. His hopes soared. Someone had come after all. The door swung open to reveal a solitary figure, backlit, his face draped in shadow, wearing only street clothes. As the man stepped under the beams of the emergency lights, Walgast saw somebody entirely new to him. The stranger had long hair, wild and unkempt, shot with streaks of gray, and a coarse beard that climbed halfway up his cheeks. His lab coat was rumpled and stained. He approached Amy's bedside with the preoccupied air of an accident victim, or the bystander to some terrible calamity. He'd done nothing so far even to acknowledge Walgast's presence. "She knows," he murmured, gazing at Amy. "How does she know?" "Who the hell are you? What's going on out there?" Still the man ignored him. An otherworldly feeling seemed to radiate off his entire person, an almost fatalistic calm. "It's strange," he said after a moment. He sighed deeply and touched his beard, sweeping his eyes over the barren room. "All of this... is this... what I wanted? I wanted there to be one, you see. Once I saw, once I knew what they were planning, how it would all end, I wanted there to be at least one."
"What are you talking about? Where's Sykes?"
At last the stranger seemed to take notice of him. He regarded Walgast closely, his face tightening with a sudden frown.
Sykes? Oh, he's dead. I rather think they're all dead, don't you?
What do you mean, dead?
Dead. Gone.
In pieces, probably.
The lucky ones, anyway. He gave his head a slow shake of wonder.
You should have seen it. The way they swooped down from the trees. Like the bats. We really should have seen that coming.
Wolgast felt completely lost.
Please. I don't know what you're talking about.
The stranger shrugged.
Well, you will.
Soon enough, I'm sorry to say. He looked at Wolgast again.
My manners.
You'll have to excuse me, Agent Wolgast. It's been a while for me. I'm Jonas Lear. He gave a rueful smile. You could say I'm the person in charge around here. Or not. Under the circumstances, I rather think nobody's in charge anymore.
Lear.
Wolgast searched his memory, but the name meant nothing. I heard an explosion.
Quite right, Lear interrupted.
That would have been the elevator. Now my guess would be it was one of the soldiers. But I was locked in the freezer, so I didn't see that part. He sighed heavily and cast his eyes around the room once more.
Not a moment of great heroism, was it, Agent Wolgast? Locking myself in the freezer? You know, I really wish there was another chair in here. I'd like to sit down. I can't tell you how long it's been since I sat down.
Wolgast shot to his feet.
Jesus.
Take mine. Just please, tell me what's going on. But Lear shook his head, his greasy hair swaying.
There's no time, I'm afraid. We have to be going. It's all over, isn't it, Amy?
He looked down at the girl's sleeping form and gently touched her hand.
Over at last.
Wolgast could stand it no more. What's over? Lear lifted his face. His eyes were full of tears.
Everything.
Lear led them down the corridor, Wolgast carrying Amy in his arms. The air smelled burnt, like molten plastic. As they turned the corner toward the elevator, Wolgast saw the first body. It was Fortis. There wasn't much left. His body looked smeared, like it had been hit and dragged by something huge. Pooling blood glistened under the throb of the emergency lights. Beyond Fortis was another one. Or so Wolgast thought. It took him a moment to understand he was looking at more of Fortis, just a different part of him. Amy's eyes were closed, but Wolgast did his best to cover them anyway, pressing her face to his chest. Beyond Fortis lay two more bodies, or three, he couldn't tell. The floor was slick with blood, so much blood that he felt his feet sliding on it, the grease of human remains. The elevator was blown away, nothing more than a hole, its darkened interior lit by the dancing sparks of broken wiring. Its heavy metal doors had shot across the hallway, caving in the opposite wall. Under the angular light of the emergency beams, Wolgast could see two more dead men, soldiers, crushed by pieces of the door. A third was propped against the wall, seated like a man taking a siesta. Except he was resting in a pool of his own blood. His face was drawn and desiccated. His uniform hung limply on his frame as if it were a size too large. Wolgast tore his gaze away. How do we get out of here?
This way,
Lear said. The fog had lifted from him. He was pure urgency and purpose now.
Quickly!
Down another corridor. Doors stood open all up and down its length, heavy metal doors identical to the one that led to Amy's chamber. And on the floor of the hallway, more bodies. But Wolgast couldn't count. The walls were riddled with bullet holes. Cartridges lay all over the floor, their brass casings gleaming.
Then a man stepped through one of the doors. Not stepped, stumbled. A big, soft man, like the ones who'd delivered Walgast's meals to his room, though his face was not familiar. He was holding a hand to a deep gash on his neck, the blood flowing through and around his fingers where they pressed into his flesh. His shirt, a white hospital tunic like Walgast's, was a glistening bib of blood.
"Hey,"
he said.
"Hey."
He looked at the three of them, then up and down the hall. He seemed not to notice the blood, or if he did, not to care.
"What happened to the lights?"
Walgast didn't know what to say. A wound like that. The man should be dead already. Walgast couldn't believe he was even standing.
"Oh,"
the bleeding man said, wobbling on his feet.
"I gotta sit down."
He slid heavily to the floor, his body seeming to cave in on itself, like a tent without poles. He took a long breath and looked up at Walgast. His body shuddered with a deep twitch.
"Am I asleep?"
Walgast said nothing. The question made no sense to him. Lear touched his shoulder.
"Agent, leave him. There's no time."
The man licked his lips. He'd lost so much blood he was becoming dehydrated. His eyes had started to flutter. His hands lay loosely, like empty gloves, on the floor at his sides.
"Because I'm here to tell you, I've been having the worst goddamn dream. I said to myself, Gray, you are having the worst dream in the world."
"I don't think it was a dream," Walgast said. The man considered this and shook his head.
"I was afraid of that."
He twitched again, a hard spasm, as if he'd been hit by a jolt of current. Lear was right. There was nothing to do for him. The blood from his neck had darkened to a deep blue-black. Walgast had to get Amy away.
"I'm sorry," Walgast said. "We have to go."
"You think you're sorry?"
the man said, and let his head rock back against the wall.
"Agent."
But Gray's mind already seemed elsewhere.
"It wasn't just me,"
he said, and closed his eyes.
"It was all of us."
They hurried on to a room with lockers and benches. A dead end, Walgast thought, but then Lear withdrew a key from his pocket and opened a door marked Mechanicals. Walgast stepped inside. Lear was on his knees, using a small knife to pry loose a metal panel. It swung free on a pair of hinges, and Walgast bent to look inside. The opening wasn't more than a yard square.
"Straight on, about 30 feet, and you'll come to an intersection. A tube leads straight up. There's a ladder inside for maintenance. It goes all the way to the top."
50 feet at least. Climbing a ladder in pitch blackness, holding Amy somehow in his arms. Walgast didn't see how he could do it.
"There has to be another way."
Lear shook his head.
"There isn't."
The man held Amy while Walgast entered the duct. Seated, his head bent low, he'd be able to pull Amy along, holding her by the waist. He backed in until his legs were straight. Lear positioned Amy between them. She seemed to be poised on the edge of awareness now. Through her thin gown, Walgast could still feel the warmth of her fever rising off her skin.
"Remember what I said. 10 yards.
Walgast nodded.
"Be careful."
"What killed those men?" But Lear didn't answer.
"Keep her close," he said. "She's everything. Now go."
Walgast began to scooch away, one hand clutching Amy by the waist, the other pulling them deeper into the duct. It was only when the panel sealed behind them that he realized that Lear had never meant to come with them. The sticks were everywhere now, all over the compound. Richards could hear the screams and the gunfire. He took extra clips from his desk and ran upstairs to Sykes's office. The room was empty. Where was Sykes? They had to establish a perimeter, push the sticks back inside the chalet, and throw the switch. Richard stepped from Sykes's office, his gun raised. Something was moving down the hall. It was Sykes. By the time Richards got to him, he had slumped to the floor, his back propped against the wall. His chest was heaving like a sprinter's, his face sheened with sweat. He was holding a wide tear on his lower arm, just above the wrist, from which blood was running freely. His gun, a .45, lay on the floor near his upturned palm.
"They're all over the place," Sykes said and swallowed. "Why didn't he kill me? The son of a bitch looked right at me."
"Which one was it?"
"What the fuck does that matter?"
Sykes shrugged.
"Your pal. Babcock. What is it with you two?"
A deep tremor moved through him.
"I don't feel so good," he said,
and then he vomited. Richards jumped away, but too late. The air tanged with the stench of bile, and something else, elemental and metallic, like turned earth. Richards felt the wetness through his pants, his socks. He knew without looking that Sykes's vomitus was full of blood.
"Fuck!"
He raised his weapon at Sykes.
"Please," Sykes said, meaning no, or maybe yes.
But either way, Richards figured he was doing Sykes a favor when he pointed the barrel at the center of his chest, the sweet spot, and then he squeezed the trigger. Lacey saw the first one come out an upper window.
So quick, like light itself. How a man would move if he were made of light.
It was up and over in an instant, vaulting off the roof into space, sailing through the air above the compound, alighting in a stand of trees 100 yards away. A man-sized flash of throbbing luminescence, like a shooting star. She'd heard the alarm as the truck pulled into the compound. The two men in the cab had argued for a minute. Should they just drive away? And Lacey had used this moment to climb out the back and scurry into the woods. That was when she'd seen the demon flying from the window. The treetops where he landed absorbed his weight with a shudder. Lacey saw what was about to happen. The driver of the truck was opening the truck's rear gate. Ordnance, the sentry had said.
Guns?
The truck was full of guns. The treetops moved again. A streak of green fell toward him.
Oh. Lacey thought. Oh! Oh!
Then there were more of them, pouring out of the building, through its windows and doors, launching themselves into the air. 10, 11, 12. And soldiers, too, everywhere, running and yelling and shooting, but their bullets did nothing. The demons were too fast, or else the bullets were harmless against them. One by one, the demons fell upon the soldiers, and they died. This was why she had come. To save Amy from the demons.
Quickly, Lacey. Quickly.
She stepped from the edge of the woods.
Halt!
Lacey froze. Should she raise her hands? The soldier appeared from the woods where he'd been hiding too. A good boy, doing what he thought was his duty. Trying not to be afraid, though of course he was. She could feel the fear coming off him, like waves of heat. He didn't know what was about to happen to him. She felt a tender pity.
"Who are you?"
"I am no one," Lacey said. And then the demon was upon him. Before he could even point his weapon, before he could finish the word he was speaking as he died. And Lacey was running toward the building. By the time they got to the base of the tube, Walgast was sweating and breathing hard. A faint light was falling down upon them. Far above, he could see the twin beams of an emergency light, and farther still, the stilled blades of a giant fan. The central ventilation shaft.
"Amy, honey," he said.
"Amy, you have to wake up." Her eyes fluttered open and closed again. He guided her arms around his neck and stood, felt her feet clamping around his waist. But he could tell she had no strength.
"You have to hold on, Amy. Please. You have to."
Her body tightened in reply. But still he'd have to use one of his arms to support her weight. This would leave only one hand free to pull them up the ladder.
"Jesus."
He turned and faced the ladder, set his foot onto the first rung. It was like a problem on a standardized test. Brad Walgast is holding a little girl. He has to climb a ladder 50 feet in a poorly lit ventilation shaft. The girl is semi-conscious at best. How does Brad Walgast save both their lives? Then he saw how he could do it. One rung at a time, he'd use his right hand to pull them up, then hook that same elbow through the ladder, balancing Amy's weight on his knee while he changed hands and moved up another rung. Then the left hand, then the right, and so on, moving Amy's weight between them, rung by rung, to the top. How much did she weigh? 50 pounds? All suspended at the moment he changed hands by the strength of a single arm. Walgast began to climb. Richards could tell from the shouts and the shooting that the sticks were outside now. He'd known what was happening to Sykes. Probably it would happen to him, too, since Sykes had puked his goddamn infected blood all over him, but he doubted he'd live long enough for this to matter. "Hey, Cole," he thought. "Hey, Cole, you weasel, you little shit. Was this what you had in mind? Is this your Pax Americana? Because there's only one outcome I can see here." There was just one thing Richards wanted now. A clean exit, with a good showing at the last. The front entrance of the chalet was all broken glass and bullet holes, the doors ripped half off their hinges, hanging kitty-corner. 3 soldiers lay dead on the floor. It looked as if they'd been shot by friendly fire in the chaos. Maybe they'd actually shot one another on purpose, just to hustle things along. Richards raised his hand and looked at the Springfield. Why would he think this would do any good? The soldiers' rifles would be no use either. He needed something larger. The armory was across the compound, behind the barracks. He'd have to make a run for it. He looked out the door, across the open ground of the compound. At least the lights were still on. Well, he thought, better now than later, since probably there would be no later. He took off at a run. The soldiers were everywhere, scattered, running, shooting at nothing, at one another. Not even pretending to make an organized defense, let alone an assault on the chalet. Richards ran full tilt, half expecting to be hit. Richards was halfway across the compound when he saw the 5-ton. It was parked at the edge of the lot, at a careless angle, its doors open. He knew what was inside it. Maybe he wouldn't have to make it across the compound after all. "Agent Doyle?" Doyle smiled.
"Lacey."
They were on the first floor of the chalet, in a small, cramped room of desks and file cabinets. Doyle had been waiting there since the shooting had started, hidden beneath a desk, waiting for Lacey. He stood.
"Do you know where they are?"
Lacey paused. There were scratches on her face and neck, and bits of leaves caught in her hair. She nodded.
"Yes. I heard you," Doyle said. "All these weeks."
Something huge was breaking open inside him. His throat choked with tears.
"I don't know how I did that."
She took his hands in hers.
"It wasn't me you heard, Agent Doyle."
At least Walgast couldn't look down. He was sweating hard now, his palms and fingers slick on the rungs as he pulled them farther up. His arms were trembling with exertion. The crooks of his elbows, where he held each rung when he traded hands, felt bruised to the bone. There was a moment, he knew, when the body simply reached its limits, an invisible line that once crossed could not be uncrossed. He pushed the thought aside and climbed. Amy's arms, crossed behind his neck, held firm. Together they ascended, rung by rung by rung. The fan was closer now. Wolgast could feel a thin breeze, cool and smelling of night, spilling over his face. He craned his neck to scan the sides of the tube for an opening. He saw it, 10 feet above him. Beside the ladder, an open duct. He'd have to push Amy in first. Somehow he'd have to manage his own weight on the ladder and hers as well while he swung her out from the ladder and into the duct. Then he'd climb in himself. They reached the opening. The fan was higher than he'd thought, another 30 feet above their heads at least. He guessed they were somewhere on the first floor of the chalet. Maybe he was supposed to go higher, find another exit. But his strength was nearly gone. He positioned his right knee to take Amy's weight and reached his left hand out. A featureless wall of cool metal met his fingertips, smooth as glass, but then he found the edge. He drew his hand back. 3 more rungs should do it. He took a deep breath and ascended, positioning the two of them just above the duct. "Amy," he rasped. His mouth and throat were dry as bone. "Wake up. Do your best to wake up, honey." He felt her breathing change against his neck as she tried to rouse. "Amy, I'm going to need you to let go when I say. I'll hold you. There's an opening in the wall. I need you to try to get your feet into it." The girl gave no reply. He hoped she had heard him. He tried to imagine how this was going to work exactly. How he was going to get her inside the duct and then himself, and couldn't. But he was out of options. If he waited any longer, he'd have no strength for any of it. "Now." He pushed with his knee, lifting Amy up. Her arms released his neck, and with his free hand he took her by the wrist, suspending her over the tube like a pendulum, and then he saw the way. He released his other hand, let her weight pull him away and to his left, toward the hole, and then her feet were inside it. She was sliding into the tube. He began to fall. He'd been falling all along. But as he felt his feet lose contact with the ladder, his hands madly scrabbling at the wall, his fingers found the lip of the duct, a thin metal ridge that bit into his skin. "Whoa!" he cried, his voice ricocheting down the length of the shaft. He seemed to be clinging to the side of the shaft by will alone. His feet were dangling in space. "Whoa now!" How he did it, he couldn't have explained. Adrenaline? Amy? That he didn't want to die, not yet. He pulled with all his might, his elbows bending slowly, drawing himself inexorably upward. First his head, and then his chest, and then his waist, and finally the rest of him, sliding into the duct. For a moment he lay still, gulping air into his lungs. He lifted his face then and saw a light ahead, some kind of opening in the floor. He twisted himself around and held Amy as he'd done before, scooting along on his backside, clutching her by the waist. The light grew stronger as they moved toward it. They came to a slatted grate. It was sealed, screwed shut from the outside. He wanted to cry. To come so close. Even if he'd been able to reach through the narrow slats somehow to find the screws with his fingers, he had no tools, no way to open it. And going back? Impossible. He'd spent the last of his strength. He heard movement below them. He pulled Amy tight. He thought of the men they'd seen. Fortis, the soldier in the pool of blood, the one called Gray. It wasn't how he wanted to die. He closed his eyes and held his breath, willing the two of them into absolute silence. Then a voice, quiet and searching. "Chief?" It was Doyle. One of the lockers was already resting on the ground at the rear of the truck. It looked like somebody had been unloading and then, in a panic, dropped it. Richard searched quickly inside the cargo compartment and found a tire iron. The hinge gave way with a bright snap. Inside, cradled in beds of foam, lay a pair of RPG-29s. He lifted the rack to find beneath it the rockets, finned cylinders about half a meter long, tipped with tandem charge heats, capable of penetrating the armor of a modern battle tank. Richards had seen what they could do. He'd placed the requisition when the order had come through to move the stakes. Better safe than sorry, he'd thought. Vampires say ah. He fixed the first rocket to the launcher. With a twist, it issued the satisfying hum that meant the warhead was armed. Thousands of years of technical advancement, the whole history of human civilization, seemed contained within that sound, the hum of an arming heat. The 29 was reusable, but Richards knew he'd only get one shot. He hoisted it to his shoulder, lifted the sighting mechanism into position, and stepped away from the truck. "Hey!" he yelled, and at precisely that moment, the sound of his voice streaming away into the gloom, a cold shudder of nausea burbled from his gut. The ground beneath him swayed, like the deck of a boat at sea. Beads of sweat were popping out all over. He felt the urge to blink, a random current from the brain. So, it was happening quicker than he'd thought. He swallowed hard and took two more steps into the light, swinging the RPG toward the treetops. "Here, kitty, kitty." An anxious minute passed as Doyle scrabbled through various drawers until he found a penknife. Standing on a chair, he used the blade to undo the screws. Walgast lowered Amy into Doyle's arms, then dropped to the floor himself. He didn't at first know whom he was seeing. Sister Lacey? She was holding the sleeping girl against her chest. Agent Walgast? Walgast looked at Doyle. "I don't get it." Doyle lifted his eyebrows. He was, like Walgast, wearing scrubs. They were too large, hanging loosely on his body. He gave a little laugh. "Trust me. I don't get it either." "This place is full of dead men," Walgast said. "Something. I don't know." "There was an explosion." He couldn't explain himself. "We know," Doyle said, nodding. "It's time for us to go." They stepped from the room into the hall. Walgast guessed they were somewhere near the rear of the chalet. It was quiet, though they could hear scattered pops of gunfire from outside. Quickly, without speaking, they made their way to the front entrance. Walgast saw the